Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
If you follow the news at all in Haiti, it's become basically a failed state that's been taken over by gangs and warlords and, you know, all sorts of horrific things happening. But as part of my work, we periodically talk to the people that matter, and whether we like it or not, some of the people that matter are the gang members. They fully acknowledge, like completely acknowledge, that the only reason that they're able to gain a foothold in the country is because young men in Haiti are blocked. They have barriers. They're constrained in terms of their own ability to lead out the lives that they would want to lead. So any gang member will tell you, if there were jobs in Haiti, if there were opportunity in Haiti, if there was anything else other than gangs, they wouldn't be able to recruit new gang members.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Paul, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
It is my pleasure to be here. Thanks so much.
Yeah, well, you are this just multifaceted human being, somebody who is basically a professor, a former wrestler, paramedic. Like, you've got all these things that you have done in your life and your career. But before we get into that, I wanted to start by asking you, where in the world were you born and raised, and what impact did that end up having on what you've ended up doing with your life and your career?
That is an amazing question. Okay, so I was born and raised in Los Angeles. West LA, for those of you who are familiar. So, which is interesting because I'm Latino, right? My mom is Mexican. My dad is from El Salvador. And if you're from LA, you know, Los Angeles is kind of geographically separated in a lot of ways. And so if you tell somebody that you're Latino and you're from LA, the first thing people ask you is, are you from East LA? Mm-hmm. And which is, no, I'm actually from West LA, which is a little interesting because, it comes with a little bit of judgment in a way.
Yeah. I can imagine.
You know, and so it's a question of, oh, you must be a Latino who doesn't like being Latino, or you must be, you know, people look at you in a particular way, right? It's something that's always fascinated me. Growing up in LA was really, really interesting because it is this, you know, this massive city. There's everything in LA. You can find everything in LA. But my upbringing inside of it was really, really very sheltered, you know. So I basically lived in a tiny Mexican country inside of Los Angeles, practically, you know. So I only spoke English at school, and outside of school, I spoke pretty much only Spanish. So even though LA is this huge, you know, megalopolis of a city with so much out there, I know that in my youth, I only got to experience a piece of it, but I could see it. You know what I mean? Like, you could see it from everywhere you were, that there was something else that was something more that was out there, but I didn't necessarily have access to it, you know? So, I think that growing up that way in a city like that really inspired in me a wanderlust. So, you know, I think one of the things, anybody who would meet me now, the first thing that they would want to talk about is like how much I've traveled and how many countries I've been to and all of that. And I think that that my upbringing in LA, you know, seeing what felt like the world, but not having access to it was something that really sparked that in me. You know, that's one piece. The other piece is that, I realized as I've traveled all over the world and particularly in Latin America, you know, I consider myself Latino. My first language is Spanish. I'm actually calling you from the Dominican Republic right now, you know, so I'm really well integrated into the Latino culture. But growing up in Los Angeles is really fascinating because in Los Angeles, Latino means Mexican pretty much, you know, even though, for example, my dad is from El Salvador. And there are lots of Salvadorans in Southern California, but they're so overpowered by the number of Mexicans. I mean, my dad married one, that to the point where my dad now, if you heard him speak, you would think that my dad was actually Mexican because he's completely lost his complete Salvadoran dialect, you know? So what's fascinating is that I grew up with an understanding of myself being Latino, but it was so heavily skewed towards a perspective that was Mexican, you know? So it's really fascinating. You know, when my wife is actually from Nicaragua, and it's been, and we live, you know, we spend a lot of time here in the Dominican Republic, in the Caribbean, and traveling all over the place. And it's so fascinating to experience culture shock in a lot of ways in a culture that you thought was your culture, you know? So, yeah. It's just, you know, it's been such an interesting thing. My wife's family, for example, they're mostly in Miami, and Miami is definitely a little Latin American town, but it's full of Cubans and Nicaraguans and Colombians and Venezuelans and they're all over the place, you know? And so her upbringing was very different, and her understanding of herself as a Latina was very different, you know? So it's something that I've had to learn over time, how it is that I associate with other people from other countries in Latin America. And you know, it's just been really interesting. And I can definitely tie that back to, I grew up in Little Mexico, you know? So,
Well, it's funny. I don't know if you've ever seen the Carlos Mencia stand-up comedy where he talks about this. He said, depending on what city you're in, Latinos basically will get labeled as being from one country or another. It's like, if you're in New York, he's like, oh, you're Puerto Rican. If you're in Miami, you're Cuban. You're in LA, you're Mexican. Something I wonder about, this is just out of a personal curiosity. So you've got these two different Latin American cultures that are integrated together, both in your upbringing and it sounds like with your wife. So I wonder, one, what are the differences between cultures and how do you integrate both of, how did your parents integrate them, as well as how do you integrate, you know, traditions, and heritage from each culture, even with your kids? Cause I've been to Nicaragua, El Salvador, Costa Rica, Mexico, all those places. And sometimes it can feel like just a mishmash of Latino people.
No, that's a great question. So I would say that growing up, at least, we were a Mexican household. So it was very clear. It's very clear to me now, looking back, that my dad basically relinquished a lot of his cultural identity. I don't know if on purpose or accidentally, but that's in fact what happened, you know, other than some food type traditions. Mm-hmm. Our household was not a particularly Salvadoran household. You know, and it's, I mean, to the point where, I mean, you know, my dad, as I said, he completely lost his own version of the language, you know, and to me, that's a pretty big thing because language is important to me, you know, so for him to have completely let go of that, I think is amazing and tragic at the same time, you know, and, you know, knowing, we can get into this later if you want, but knowing my parents' history and, you know, they, my parents actually separated about 4 years ago. Which to me adds a whole layer of tragedy to him. You know, he gave up so much of what he saw as his cultural identity for her. Yeah. And in the end, it didn't work out, you know? But at least in our household, like now, so my wife is Nicaraguan and in reality, Nicaraguan culture and Salvadoran culture have a tremendous amount in common. The dialectical versions of Spanish that they speak in both countries are really very close. A lot of the, and a lot of Nicaraguan food, how should I say, the variety of Nicaraguan food approximates to me the variety of Mexican food. that you see. Yeah. So that's actually been a really nice cultural integration for me. And if anything, it has allowed me to reconnect more with my own Central American identity and not just Mexican, you know. So that's actually been really nice. That's something I really appreciate about my wife and her family, that it's allowed me to explore a part of my own heritage in a way that I never had been able to before.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Four.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that what's fascinating to me about this is this idea of cultural identity. I mean, you grew up in West LA, and I know my sister lived in West LA, and I lived in West LA for a while, West LA being predominantly white. And I think what's fascinating to me is you mentioned, you know, at home, you were primarily Mexican. So like, I wonder, what is it that enables sort of preservation of cultural identity? Because I think about this frequently with my sister, because, you know, we're from one part of India. We're from Southern India, from Andhra. We speak Telugu. My brother-in-law is from Bengal, so he speaks Bengali. Right. And I always think to myself, I'm like, you know, looking at their son, I'm like, he's probably going to end up speaking both languages because he has, you know, grandmothers who speak to him both, and he's a little genius. But I always think about like, okay, how do you, my first thought always is like, if I marry a girl who is not from the part of India I'm from, and if I marry a girl who's not Indian, the first thing to go is going to be language, because right. Like, to the point where I was speaking to my grandmother before she passed away, and one of my cousins who's known me for like 25 years, she was like, you speak Telugu? I was like, Rama, I'm fluent in Telugu. Because the funny thing is, in our household, it's the kind of thing where somehow we just got into this rhythm where, you know, my parents will kind of mix English and Telugu together. And then if they say something in Telugu to us, we reply to them in English.
Right.
So I wonder how you think about this in terms of your own kids and how that cultural identity, you know, was preserved when you're sort of, you've got this layer of, you know, the West LA bubble.
Yeah, there's so much to unpack in everything you just said right now. So for me, as I mentioned before, language is really important. I speak six languages, and my mom was a translator. So her job before she retired, her job was that she worked in the school district, and she worked as an English-Spanish translator. So one of the things that was really interesting in our household is that basically Spanglish was forbidden. If you're speaking English, speak English. If you're speaking Spanish, speak Spanish, right? And that is really, really rare, you know, especially for, you know, I was born in Los Angeles. I'm a first gen kid. I'm American, you know? And so the most common thing is that kids like me, because my profile, Spanglish all day long. You know, every time I go to Miami, Spanglish is the predominant language there, you know? But it was forbidden in my household. Just, you know, that it was an abomination to my mom, that whole concept of mixing the words. You know the words, so say the words, you know? So that's something that is different in a lot of ways. But in terms of like preserving culture, I think the language is super important, right? Your language is your ticket to access the culture. And we see that completely. So I grew up on my mom's side with a couple of cousins, their dad was my uncle and their mom was a white American woman. And so my uncle, I don't know, he worked a lot. They weren't very intentional about it. And his kids never learned Spanish. And so that was really weird, right? Because my grandparents could speak English. But it was, you know, basic communication English. It wasn't like, let's have a conversation about life and philosophy and politics in English, you know?
Yeah.
So that was a huge barrier for them, right? Not being able to access the culture and the language and the information has made them basically culturally illiterate in terms of their Latin side, right? At the same time, you meet a lot of people in a place like Los Angeles who are functionally illiterate in Spanish. Like they could go to Mexico and they could probably order food, but the same thing, they couldn't have a deep conversation. They'd struggle to find the words. You know, there's a fairly low level. And at the same time, because of the way that they are being raised or have been raised, they are very deeply ingrained in the culture nonetheless. You know, so there, a lot of it is the explicitness with which you carry on those traditions. You know, so my family, I had every access to the culture because I speak the language fluently, and we would go to Mexico fairly often and, you know, visit family and whatever. But at the same time, my house, if you walked into my parents' house, you wouldn't say, oh, a Mexican family lives here, because they're, you know, my mom doesn't really like colors on the wall. So my mom has all the walls are white. You know, she doesn't have an altar anywhere, you know, or anything like that. A lot of the things that you might think stereotypically would be part of the culture. And that wasn't present in my house, you know? So in a lot of ways, I was not as Mexican as some other people who might actually speak the language very poorly, but were steeped on a day-to-day basis in the culture.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, but then it kind of circles more, right? So because of so many things like that, I've lived overseas by and large for over a decade now, primarily in Latin America. And interestingly, I've been able to integrate really, really well just about anywhere in Latin America. One, because I have full access to the language, right? But in a lot of ways, I think also my lack of deep Mexican-ness somehow has made me a little bit more open, adaptable, fungible to cultural differences in other places that I go to, you know? So it's helped me, it's hurt me, it's, you know, it's, um, I kind of have to take it as appreciating what I have and what I've been able to do with it, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's funny because like I'm a brown person, right? So like when I go into a Latin American country, like I blend right in. So yeah, and you know, like I lived in Brazil for 6 months and my Portuguese is good enough that I can function relatively well at this point, to the point where I remember when we did our study abroad there, people were mistaking me for Portuguese. And then think about language. I noticed something, like Bengalis in particular, like all my friends who are Bengali, I noticed that they speak to their parents, even to this day, when I hear my brother-in-law talk on the phone, they take a lot of pride in language, whereas we're basically just, hey, we know this, we don't need to use it. But one of the things I wonder about, you know, you're an educator, so we'll definitely need to talk about education, but we'll come back to it in a bit. I think about language learning and the fact that like, if you asked me to deconstruct how I actually learned Telugu, like our native language, I couldn't tell you. All I remember was that we were moving from Australia to Canada. We landed for 6 weeks. My grandmother didn't speak English. By the time we left, I was fluent. And I, to this day, have no idea like how that process worked. And it always made me wonder, like, why the hell do we wait until seventh grade to teach kids new languages when they're like sponges in kindergarten? Like if kids are learning languages this fast at that age, wouldn't it make more sense to do it like way earlier in school?
100%. I mean, I think a lot of it having been involved in sort of the educational system and the educational processes, I think a lot of it comes down to bureaucracy, and at least in the United States, you know, a lot of it comes down to bureaucracy and how it is that money is allocated, you know. So there are so many studies out there that show, you know, the benefits of bilingualism, not just because you can speak two languages, but because of the cognitive abilities it helps you develop in other unrelated ways oftentimes. But it's often the case that those benefits don't start to show up until a couple of years later. Mm-hmm. And so in the relatively younger years, what they find is that there is a statistician would call a statistically significant difference in terms of literacy development in English when there are, for example, two languages spoken at home. And so what I think that a lot of the schools are afraid of is that showing those lower scores early on is going to somehow affect the ranking of the school or how it is that they receive their funding and all of these things. So I know that we definitely got it with our kids. We got a lot of pressure to have them be monolingual, which absolutely was not going to happen. And you can tell me that all you want, but I'm not going to do that. But we got a lot of pressure in that direction early on with our kids. And I think it's the dumbest thing ever. You know, it's an investment that you make early on for them to really be able to take off later, you know? So.
Yeah. I noticed the one thing that I could see when I would see like my, you know, Caucasian friends, like learn a Latin American language, like I don't sound like a damn gringo when I pronounce Spanish words, like I can pronounce them properly. And I think it's partially because of the fact that I spoke another language. Yeah. Like there was one of the funniest things I realized was like my name, like Srinivas Rao, is very hard for Brazilians to say. Right. And it took me a while. I was like, that's because there's not a single word in Portuguese where the consonants S and R are mixed together. Right. So like I realized, I was like, oh, your tongue can't even make this sound. You know, it is what's amazing. But this
I'm
is
sure
another
they
funny
added
thing.
Eyes everywhere, right? I'm sure you were S-E-D-D-V-A-S-I.
Yeah. Of course, like I had a friend named Tim and he was Timochi. So we just called him Chimochi every day. Like that was his nickname. But, you know, the other thing I've always seen, you know, foreigners, particularly people who speak English and grown up in Western countries, like they go to like some other country and they just start talking louder. And I'm like, you moron, they can't understand you. It's not that they can't hear you. They're not deaf. Like I've always thought that was so absurd.
I lived in Paris for a couple of years and I'll never forget coming down to the metro. And there was this just enormous American guy yelling at the guy in the booth. I want to go to the goddamn Eiffel Tower. You can yell it as loud as you want, but he's still not going to understand you.
Totally. Well, talk to me about what sent you down this path of this like multi-hyphenate career of diplomat, professor, you know, former wrestler, and, you know, like all this stuff. Like this is kind of a bizarre career.
It is. You know, I think now with the hindsight of age and, you know, being able to look back on a compendium of work, I never would have thought of myself as multi-passionate, as bizarre as that sounds, because I am somebody who's done a lot of things, but I just always thought of myself as curious. But, you know, as I look back, over the last, 30 plus years of my life, I realized that the unifying factor in my life has been a desire to positively impact lives. And that's been like, if I have to encapsulate me in one concept, it's that. It's a desire to positively impact people's lives, you know? And so this is why, for example, early on, one of my first jobs was that I was a lifeguard. And I loved that. That was a great job. It was, it was fantastic. And then later I became an EMT and later I became a professor. I was a professor of economics for a long time. All of these things seem so far away from each other, that I eventually left academia and I became a diplomat serving overseas. And now I run my own company. That now that I understand so much of my own direction, my own company made so much sense. Something explicitly designed, to do exactly that, this idea of improving people's lives. But it's been such an interesting internal journey. We talk so much about doing the work, I think it's a very cheesy expression, but it's factual. There's a lot of questioning of yourself that comes with age and experience. And, looking back and what have I done and has it been worth it? Has it meant anything? And that's always been something that's really important to me, to know that my work has, meaning and value and things that translate to people, So interestingly, for example, I've spent years, a really long time, feeling like I was a frustrated doctor. Like part of it, the inside of me, I always felt like I wanted to be a doctor, And if you ask people, why they want to be a doctor, people give you all kinds of reasons. A lot of them, it's I like the money, or I like the science and I think it's fascinating. And for me, I know that I wanted to do it because I wanted to be there to help people in their time of need. This was what I wanted to do, to the point where even a few years ago where I was leaving, the diplomatic service, which is a big change, the diplomatic service isn't a regular job that you just walk away from, So it was a really big change to want to leave that. And I was, mid 40s at that point. And my wife was like, well, why don't you go back to med school? And you're like, oh man, I actually did a lot of serious research on what med school looks like for a guy who's 40 and has a couple of kids and whatever. And I couldn't do it, And so I actually left that feeling almost worse in a lot of ways, like this, maybe that was my chance to do it, But as I started doing a lot more of this sort of inner work and really understanding my purpose and why I'm here and why I do things, I realized that in reality, my whole life has been about finding ways to have a positive impact on people's lives. And it's just been in different ways, So so much of the work that I do now with people is helping them along that same path. And so people are really afraid, when you tell people, let's do some work and talk about, your purpose. What's the impact that you want to have on the world and that sort of thing? There's so much trepidation, especially among people like myself, who I would say are sort of like the high achievers, people who have dedicated so much work and so much time and reached a certain level in a lot of ways in their academic and career accomplishments. And they're afraid to find out somehow that all of it has been in the wrong direction. You know what I mean? Like I've wasted my life and, I should have done something else kind of thing. And people are really afraid to go down that road, but I can tell you that having gone through this process with literally thousands of people, no one ever comes out of that process feeling that way. Because everyone, your purpose is something inherent in you, right? And whether or not you do a good job of nurturing it and aligning your life to it, your purpose leaks out. Your purpose finds ways to manifest in your life, So it's always an interesting process for people to say, wow, I did do that. I have been doing that. Have I been doing it as well as I could have? Not necessarily, you know what I mean? But it's not the case that people come out going, you know what? My life went completely in the wrong direction. I'm off the rails, you know? So, so that's, you know, that's been a really fascinating part of the journey, which has really given me a lot of, comfort about being such a multi-passionate kind of person, you know, that, you know, it's easy to say, oh, you know what? You're just a super ADHD person. You can't stick with anything, you know, or whatever it is. But the truth is that one, I think there's nothing wrong with having a personality that's always searching for something better, something more, a better way to have the impact that you want to have in life, you know? So I think that's great. I encourage that in people all the time. But at the same time, it's understanding that you're still doing things that are aligned with your core in some way, and that you are advancing something inherent, something deep inside of you, you know? So I think it's, I'm actually really happy with the way that my life and my career has played out.
Yeah.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Kind of reminds me of something Sam Altman has said, you know, which I've mentioned before, where he said, you know, whatever you do next should make whatever you did previously look like a footnote in your career. And
I
always love that.
That's tremendous.
The idea that we could be defined by only one thing for our entire lives has never really resonated with me. But I want to take some time to talk about education in particular. And this is something that I get into with everybody who has spent time in academia. So you being both a parent and a former educator, somebody who's come from academia, let's say that they had it basically brought you in to be the head of education policy, which is a job I'm sure you could do better than Betsy DeVos, which is a job that most of us could do better than Betsy DeVos. But let's say that you were brought in to restructure the whole thing from the ground up, assuming that, you know, we basically don't have, we can throw away the rule book. what would you change about it? Like, what do you think is actually good? I mean, because obviously you worked in academia, so there has to be something that you find compelling about it. My dad's an academic. I grew up surrounded by professors.
Sure.
So this is an ongoing debate between me and my dad, like the value of formal education. Like, I'm perfectly okay with the value of learning. I think the structure is questionable. But that's my opinion. I want to hear it from your standpoint. If you were tasked with redesigning the whole thing, what would you do?
That is amazing. Okay. So I think one of the things that I would definitely do, one of the things that I, especially in the United States, that we really miss is the value of technical and vocational education. And I say this having grown up in a very blue collar household, you know, so my dad was a mechanic. My dad, my dad was a mechanic in title, but in reality, my dad is a master craftsman. You know, this is when you think about somebody who is living their purpose, somebody who is, in touch with what their true talent and gift to the world is. My dad having a job fixing things is, there's nothing more aligned than that, you know? And I having spent time, a long time in academia and sort of higher education like that, I think that we have created a system where there is not sufficient value given to those kinds of tasks and that kind of education. So I think that's one thing. You know, I think there are so many kids that have a tremendous amount of pressure to go to college and be college educated. When that might not necessarily be the right avenue for them. So I think that's something we need to consider, you know, that there are these really, really valuable, really useful, really noble, careers out there that we're not dedicating enough resources to. That's one side. The other side is for me. So I'm an economist by training. My specialty is in developing countries. So countries that are, you know, still working through a lot of things, be they economic or political, you know, environmental, whatever it is. And for me, the biggest value in education is not just to the individual, but what it means for society at large, right? Do you have a society where people are not only literate and numerate, but have developed, for example, good critical thinking skills?
Yeah.
When, you know, when something is proposed to them, are they able to break down the argument, understand both sides, and come to a decision based on, you know, the evidence placed before them and their powers of, you know, ratiocination kind of a thing, you know? And to me, that the more you have of those people, the more likely you are to have a society where I hesitate to say democratic ideals, you know, but a society that values the individual and the individual understands their role within the larger society, that, you know, political transitions are peaceful. There's opportunities, economic opportunities for those who want to seek them, you know? So I think that's a really, really big piece that I would strive to make, the education system, one, something that focuses not just on sort of the basic reading and writing, but I would put a lot of emphasis into what I would call critical thinking and analysis. I don't see that enough. And then I would say that, you know, coming from the culture that I come from and seeing how access to education translates later to access to jobs, and then that access to job or limited access to job over time translates to fairly limited intergenerational wealth and the implications of that. You know, I would definitely try to structure some of these educational institutions to infuse them with a sense of equity that, basically that helps create opportunities for people who wouldn't necessarily have them in otherwise, you know? And when I say opportunity, I think half of it is knowledge about possibilities that they don't have access to. You know, it's one of the things that I've learned over time, you know, and I see the benefit that my kids will have over me, you know, that mm-hmm. I grew up in a blue collar household, a directly immigrant household. And there were so many things that could have pushed me or my sister or, you know, others like us in a much stronger direction than what we were provided, you know, that in the end has harmed us. You know, there's so many things that I've had to learn. For one of them, for example, as the child of Latino immigrants, I never learned the value, the importance, or the skill of networking. Like this idea of that who you know matters tremendously, and that there's a way that you foster those relationships and interactions that can help you enormously. You know, as an adult, I've learned the value of it, but I have to admit that I'm actually really bad at it. You know, it's a real struggle anytime for me that I know that I have to be in networking mode. I have my mantras and why it's important and I got to do this and all of that. But, you know, it's something that my kids are going to grow up with a very different understanding, you know, that, you know, they're going to grow up having seen their parents networking all the time and seeing what the benefit of that has been, you know, so.
Totally.
There's a lot there.
That raises so many questions, you know, like, first let me comment on the critical thinking piece, because I was an econ major and, you know, I was a straight A student in high school, got to Berkeley and started getting C's. And what I realized, to your point, was that in high school, you can get by, you know, just memorizing. Like, I remember one of my friends, like, were you a straight A student in high school? I'm like, yeah, I'm Indian. Of course I was a straight A student in high school. My parents would have disowned us if we didn't get straight A's. You know, all joking aside, but I realized the very idea that the very, you know, sort of discipline that I told my friend, I was like, you don't have to be smart to get straight A's in high school. You have to be disciplined. Any moron
right.
straight A's in high school. But the thing is, you get to college and that changes, you know, dramatically, where I realized, like, now after 1,000 interviews and all the books I've read The Wealth of Nations, if I sat down to take an Econ 1 midterm at Berkeley, I could probably get a decent grade just through, you know, reasoning and critical thinking based on different frameworks and mental models. Nobody yeah. taught me how to study that way at all. Yeah. That was one huge thing that was really kind of left out. But I want to bring back a clip from a conversation I had with David Epstein that I think will make a nice segue into talking a bit more about not only education, but the work that you do. Take a listen.
We will underestimate future change at every time point, even when we're very old. But at no time is that more true than from about 18 to the late 20s. That's when you undergo mm-hmm. the fastest time of personality yeah. change. Mm-hmm. And so essentially right at the start of that period, we're telling someone pick now, which is really asking them to pick for a person they don't yet know. Mm-hmm. And certainly in a world they can't yet conceive, unless they have a crystal ball that most people don't. And so I think it's a particularly bad time to make ironclad long-term plans. And we should be much more oriented toward pick something, you know, and I'm stealing this idea from the economist and statistician, Robert Miller. We should orient people toward do the thing that's going to give you a high information signal about whether it fits you or not.
So you're an academic. Like, I'm yeah. curious about what you make of that, because, like, I honestly felt like that advice was completely left out of the way that I was taught to make choices.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and my multi-passionateness is a lifelong thing for me. You know, when I was in college, I majored in economics, but I also majored in French and I also majored in geology, you know, because I couldn't pick. I loved all of them. You know, I would love to see what society looked like, you know, if we could implement something like along the lines of what he says. You know, I mean, for one, we don't really do apprenticeships anymore, right? Mm-hmm. Like this situation where you could, you know, go out into the world, offer up your skills, see what fits you, see what doesn't fit you, you know, find what aligns with you and then go deep with that.
Yeah.
You know, I think that would be amazing. You know, and the other side of it is that so much of our educational system, I think, is based on a very antiquated and agrarian structure. So for one, you know, I think that so much of the hurry that we have was that our ancestry is one where, you know, if people live to be in their mid 40s, they'd live to be old, you know? So there was a hurry. You got to pick now. You got to do it now. You got to have babies now, you know? And I, you know, and we've forgotten that, lifespans have increased, that, you know, we don't have to keep overpopulating the earth, and, you know, we can do things on our own timeline in a lot of ways. So I would love to see more of that flexibility.
Well, let's talk about your work as a diplomat in developing countries, because one of the things that has become very apparent to me after, you know, 10 years or 13 plus years of doing this show and all of the interviews I've done, having traveled all over the world, having, you know, been raised by Indian immigrant parents, much like yourself, you know, having had the immigrant experience, we talk about things like purpose and, you know, passion and all these stuff. And I realize, like, this is such a privileged conversation that when you see places where there is no upward mobility, you begin to kind of think, okay, wait a minute. This is, we think of the 1% as billionaires, but in all reality, like, if you're lucky enough to even be having this conversation or contemplating these ideas, you're in a completely, you know, different situation. Because the thing I realized when I saw places like India, I saw the favelas in Brazil, like, wow, these people are born into circumstances and situations where there is no upward mobility. But you've been a diplomat, and I'm curious, like, you know, when we watch the news, for example, what it looks like on a daily basis is that the world is coming apart at the seams. But I also know that media is, you know, basically a window, not, you know, giving us the entire picture. So what do we miss about all of this?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So there's a couple of things there. So one of them is that I think there's a difference between people's circumstances and what they're sort of born into and their inner selves in a lot of ways. So I would push back a little bit on this idea that, for example, that purpose is a sort of first world kind of a thing. And I say that having traveled all over the world, you know, anytime that I go somewhere, I get out of the cities. I talk to the taxi drivers. I talk to the fishermen and the farmers, and I talk to anybody who will give me a minute of their time, you know, and, in some way, I find a way to ask them basically, what's your dream? Like, what would your, you know, what is your paradise on earth look like for you, or something along those lines? And the truth is that everyone has an answer. Everyone thinks about it. You know, everyone thinks about some situation that to them is meaningful. And it could be on different scales, and it could be in different ways. But I think that everyone has a concept of purpose. The other side of that is exactly what you say, though, right? There are very real social, cultural, economic, institutional barriers that prevent people from living them out. And that's a whole other situation, you know? So like I do a lot of work now with Haiti. And, you know, if you follow the news at all in Haiti, it's become basically a failed state that's been taken over by gangs and warlords and, you know, all sorts of horrific things happening. But as part of my work, we periodically talk to the people that matter, and whether we like it or not, some of the people that matter are the gang members. They fully acknowledge, like, completely acknowledge that the only reason that they're able to gain a foothold in the country is because young men in Haiti are blocked. They have barriers. They're constrained in terms of their own ability to lead out the lives that they would want to lead. So any gang member will tell you, if there were jobs in Haiti, if there were opportunity in Haiti, if there was anything else other than gangs, they wouldn't be able to recruit new gang members, right? So that part is really fascinating, you know, just to understand that, you know, to see that all over the world, people are not that different. People have their dreams and their visions of the future that they want. And it's really a question of the circumstances that either promote them or prevent them from getting there, you know? On the diplomat side, though, you know, there's one of the reasons that I'll get to that. But the diplomatic piece is really interesting because there are so many moving parts. And the idea of, for example, you know, and I'm most familiar with the United States example, you know, but the idea that I think gets put out a lot is that the US government is this single monolithic entity that behaves as a coordinated machine. So, you know, there's so much about, you know, US policy says this and therefore it has all these implications, or, you know, because one agency has done something that is the view of the United States government somehow or something like that. And that's really, you know, when I see TV shows and when I hear the news, that stuff kind of makes me laugh, because when you're in the room, you realize that actually there are 100 different opinions, that even within the government itself, there are opposing objectives, you know, so the idea that there is a unified stance on anything is a little bit naive in some ways, you know, and it comes down to who has the ultimate deciding power. And oftentimes that comes down to who has control over the resources that are going to be dedicated to things, you know? So it's fascinating in that sense to see that it's actually as interesting and as complex as things might seem sometimes on TV. The reality is that it's actually much more complex. Okay. The second thing is that there is what I would call an information ceiling. So, you know, there are thousands and thousands of diplomats and civil servants, you know, working with all sorts of information. And there is a real cap to the information to which you have access, that doesn't always coincide with the level of access or information necessary to make the ultimate judgment calls. So I think, you know, and I say this having been somebody who's, you know, who's held a top secret clearance and all of these things, it's even that doesn't necessarily mean much, right? That there's always a level higher that I think has multiple perspectives that you as an individual don't see. So it's a really complicated dance in a lot of ways, which for someone like me becomes frustrating. And, you know, that's where I wanted to start the answer was here, which is that one of the reasons why I left the diplomatic service was because, you know, as I said, my desire in life is to have a positive impact on people. And I got to the point where I realized that everything that I was trying to do ultimately ended up being changed, watered down, bastardized into something that was not what I had envisioned and not what had been the point in the first place. And, you know, and part of it is because, you know, I'm pushing something, but there are probably, as I said, larger considerations, you know, things that go above and beyond the scope that I have. But, you know, and you're trying to fight the good fight in a lot of ways. And then you realize that that's the end result has very little connection oftentimes with the original vision. And I got to the point where it was frustrating. It was just too much for me. You know, like I really wanted to see that my work was having the impact that I wanted to have. And that to me is ultimately what led me to walk away from that career.
Yeah. Well, I've kind of picked your brain about everything imaginable without letting you tell us a bit about what you actually do today. But I feel like we've kind of been talking about that, you know, sort of implicitly throughout. So what is it that you actually do with people? Like, tell us about, you know, kind of, you know, how you work with people and, you know, with this idea of purpose and story and all of this stuff.
For sure. Yeah. So I am the co-founder together with my wife of a company that's called Be Act Change. And so we're sort of a small company still, but we work primarily. Well, so she comes also from the international development background. And so we took a lot of what we would see in international development and use that as sort of our inspiration for how we approach these things. So one of the things that you see in international development is basically large organizations, you know, it's the UN, it's the World Bank, it's whatever, these large organizations that come into communities. They have a technical expert come in, do an analysis. The expert says, well, this community needs these three things. You know, they need you know, clean water, electricity, and, you know, good education kind of a thing. And so that that entity pumps millions of dollars into it. They take nice pictures, you know, there's good things that happen. And then the instant that the money runs out, everything reverts back to how it was. So it's the biggest problem in international development is this idea of what they call sustainability. And it's not so much like environmental sustainability as we normally talk about it, but it's this idea of the long-term impact of the work that we're doing. It's just not there. We don't see it. Fundamentally, I think it's because there was no buy-in from the communities in which we were working, right? There was no legitimate collaboration, co-creation. Nobody really asked them, what do you guys think you need? You know, what do you see as the potential solution? So, you know, part of the work that we did was changing that approach completely. And instead of going into these communities and assessing, we went into these communities completely as listeners and start listening to people and asking people, really valuing the local knowledge and that sort of thing. And the impact was tremendous. It was enormous. Like even we started seeing change in these communities before we ever even spent any money, because the real value was that we were bringing together the people that mattered, the decision makers, and having them talk to each other. And it wasn't something that had happened before, you know? So we start telling our colleagues, we're like, man, you guys got to get on this because, you know, this is tremendous. And people start telling us, that's great. How do I listen? We're like, what do you mean? How do I listen? And they're like, well, I don't think that I've ever been asked those questions. I don't think I've ever been listened to. So I don't really know how to do it. And then we went, oh my gosh, this is so much deeper than we thought, you know? And then we realized that there are so many layers on top of that, right? People are not asked, what is your need? What is your dream? What is your purpose? You know, so really we built this company out of that experience and that information that we were seeing working all over the world, you know? So really our business now we work with what we call high achieving individuals. And it's easy to picture what you think a high achiever is, but it's often something that you didn't even think about. You know, the high achiever is the person that you, not just the one who does well and excels and, you know, like me or you for sure, but, you know, the person who is the one that the family depends on, the person who, is the one that's always getting called to bail people out. You know, they're the person who puts oftentimes their own needs and their own happiness secondary to those around them and that sort of thing. You know, so we work a lot with the high achiever. We work a lot with, corporate entities, a lot with NGOs as well. And really it's starting to ask those questions about, you know, what do you see as, what's the legacy you want to leave? What are the things that you want to be sought out for? You know, like when somebody calls you on the phone and says, hey, Paul, I need your help. What is it that you want them to be calling you about? You know, and what are the things that you've overcome in your life? You know, and I can think of a lot, you know, I know that I have overcome. I mean, the things that you have overcome are going to keep coming back, right? The things that I struggle with, you know, I struggle with, for example, being free, being silly. It's a tough thing for me, you know? So it's one of the things that I struggle with. And I have tools that I have incorporated into my routine to help me with those things. And so a lot of the work that we do is basically building up that resilience with people as well, you know? And so we do this with teams. We've worked a lot, as I said, a lot with NGOs and helping them come together as a team and do a lot of mission, vision, purpose, strategic planning and that sort of thing. My expertise is in strategic planning. So it's really incorporating those tools. You know, and it's been really such satisfying work. We actually do have a book that my wife is primary author on. It's called Creating Your Limitless Life. And it's something that, you know, when we thought about what does it look like when you're living your purpose, you understand your purpose, you're aligning your actions to it, you're building the resilience tools that help you stay on that path. You know, what, trying to think about how do you describe that feeling? And it's a feeling of limitlessness, you know? And so that's really what we've tried to help our clients with. moving forward. And it's been such a really fulfilling experience for us because, you know, she and I align that way in wanting to make a positive impact on people's lives. And it's so satisfying for us to be specifically in the business of doing that, you know?
Yeah. It's kind of funny because it almost brings us full circle when we talk about, you know, education. And I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Accepted with Justin Long, but he doesn't get into college. He prints a fake acceptance letter and all that. But I think the thing that struck me most about that movie where Lewis Black is the dean and he's like, these people have all paid tuition. Like they're here for an experience. He's like, what experience is that? And he, you know, then he finally says to himself, well, maybe I should just ask them. And
exactly.
But you think about it, like, I don't think I can think of a single time in my entire life when I was going through my education where somebody asked me, well, what are you interested in?
Right.
Yeah. You know, like, particularly you grew up in an Indian immigrant family. It's like, so I to this day will never forget my dad sitting at the coffee table with one of my uncles, like we're at the dinner table. He was visiting. He had a son in ninth grade. And he was like, so what's he interested in? Does he want to be a doctor, lawyer, or engineer? And
exactly.
The guy looks at him and he's like, well, right now, the only thing he's interested in is girls. And I'm like, that's the only thing he should be interested in. He's in ninth grade.
Exactly. I could tell you the same, you know, my parents very much wanted me to become an engineer. That was their dream for me, you know, and we see that, you know, I think in a lot of ways, and I'm, as an economist, I went to school with a lot of Indian friends. So, you know, I can see that their experience was often a little bit different than mine, but at the same time, there was so much commonality in seeing that, that the kids inherit, I think, a lot of their parents' broken dreams in some ways, you know? So it's absolutely tough. Yeah.
Well, this has been absolutely fascinating. So I have one last question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews at the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Oh, I love that. Okay. I'm actually really glad you asked that because as I was looking at your podcast, it's an interesting word, right? It's unmistakable. And as I listened to some of your previous episodes and, you know, for the listeners out there, if you haven't heard the interview with Bruce Feiler, I think is tremendous. So, I highly recommend it. But to me, unmistakable as I have interpreted it and understood it in, especially in your context with, which I think aligns very much with my own, is that you are living authentically. It's unmistakable because it comes from you and what comes from you is inherently unique. There's nobody out there. And I say this not generically, but I'm, you know, if you're listening and you're the person who thinks there's, you know, there's nothing special about me, there's nothing, you know, there's nothing that I contribute to this world that's different from anyone else, I would challenge that all the way because every person has something unique and powerful that is their gift to the world. And when you tap into that and when you live that and when you show that to the world, you become unmistakable. There's no one else like you.
Amazing. Well, I have enjoyed talking to you so much. I can't thank you for taking the time to join us and share your insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and everything else you're up to?
Absolutely. Yeah, this has been my pleasure. This has been great. Thank you so much. You can find us at, we have a website, beatchange.com. We have a nice Instagram account, which is b.act.change. And you can definitely find me on LinkedIn, Dr. Paul Rivera. Anybody who's got questions, things they want to talk about some more, I am really, really happy to connect with anyone who's like-minded. So I really appreciate that.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch. The skills that are essential for standing out and thriving, no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here, like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this, AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.